Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
This is show number 59. Chapters 4 through 7, completing the novelette version of The Moon Pool by Abraham Merritt. Unfortunately, it seems that I am going to be stuck with these glitches as long as I am doing video simultaneously with audio, at least live streaming it. I haven't yet tried pre-recording video and audio and then uploading. That would certainly be something to attempt. I might experiment with it today, tomorrow, and then that would guide what I do Sunday. So I'm not certain quite yet whether I am going to be on this weekend with the magazine version of Triplanetary live, or potentially next Sunday at the usual time with a pre-recorded incarnation of that. Anyway, I found this quite interesting. You can definitely see where Merritt rewrote and condensed the original story in order to fit it into his finished novel. The main thing being, of course, that in the novel, Goodwin sets out pretty much immediately and doesn't wait for years. But also there is the Avaloha, which is much less a prominent element in the novel version.
Chapter 4, The Moon Rock.
I do not intend to tell you now, Throckmorton continued, the results of the next 2 weeks, Goodwin, nor of what we found. Later, if I am allowed, I will lay all that before you. It is sufficient to say that at the end of those 2 weeks I had found confirmation of many of my theories, and we were well underway to solve a mystery of humanity's youth, so we thought. But enough, I must hurry on to the first stirrings of the inexplicable thing that was in store for us. The place, for all its decay and desolation, had not infected us with any trace of morbidity. That is, not Edith Stanton or myself. My wife was happy. Never had she been happier. Stanton and she, while engrossed in the work as much as I, were of the same age, and they frankly enjoyed the companionship that only youth can give youth. I was glad, never jealous. But Thora was very unhappy. She was a Swede, as you know, and in her blood ran the beliefs and superstitions of the Northland, some of them so strangely akin to that of this far southern land, beliefs of spirits of mountain and forest and water, werewolves and beings malign. From the first she showed a curious sensitivity to what I suppose may be called the influences of the place. She said it smelled of ghosts and warlocks. I laughed at her then, but now I believe that this sensitivity of what we call primitive people is perhaps only a clearer perception of the unknown which we, who deny the unknown, have lost. A prey to these fears, Thora always followed my wife about like a shadow, carried with her always a little sharp hand axe, and although we twitted her about the futility of chopping phantoms with such a weapon, she would not relinquish it. 2 weeks slipped by, and at their end the spokesman for our natives came to us. The next night was the full of the moon, he said. He reminded me of my promise. They would go back to their village next morning, they would return after the third night, as at that time the power of the Ani would begin to wane with the moon. They left us sundry charms for our protection, and solemnly cautioned us to keep as far away as possible from Nantanak during their absence, although their leader politely informed us that no doubt we were stronger than the spirits. Half exasperated, half amused, I watched them go. No work could be done without them, of course, so we decided to spend the days of their absence junketing about the southern islets of the group. Under the moon, the ruins were inexpressibly weird and beautiful. We marked down several spots for subsequent exploration, and on the morning of the third day set forth along the east face of the breakwater for our camp on Ushin Tau, planning to have everything in readiness for the return of our men the next day. We landed just before dusk, tired, and ready for our cots. It was only a little after 10 o'clock when Edith awakened me. "Listen," she said. "Lean over with your ear close to the ground." I did so, and seemed to hear, far, far below, as though coming up from great distances, a faint chanting. It gathered strength, died down, ended, began, gathered volume, faded away into silence. It's the waves rolling on rocks somewhere, I said. We're probably over some ledge of rock that carries the sound. It's the first time I've heard it, replied my wife doubtfully. We listened again. Then, through the dim rhythms deep beneath us, another sound came. It drifted across the lagoon that lay between us and Nantanak in little tinkling waves. It was music of a sort. I won't describe the strange effect it had upon me. You felt it. You mean on the deck? I asked. Throckmorton nodded. I went to the flap of the tent, he continued, and peered out. As I did so, Stanton lifted his flap and walked out into the moonlight, looking over to the other islet and listening. I called to him. That's the queerest sound, he said. He listened again. Crystalline, like little notes of translucent glass, like the bells of crystal on the sistrums of Isis at Dendara Temple, he added half dreamily. We gazed intently at the island. Suddenly, on the gigantic seawall, moving slowly, rhythmically, we saw a little group of lights. Stanton laughed. The beggars, he exclaimed. That's why they wanted to get away, is it? Don't you see, Dave, it's some sort of a festival, rites of some kind that they hold during the full moon. That's why they were so eager to have us keep away, too. I felt a curious sense of relief, although I had not been sensible of any oppression. The explanation seemed good. It explained the tinkling music and also the chanting. Worshippers, no doubt, in the ruins. Their voices carried along passages I now knew honeycombed the whole Nanmatal. Let's slip over, suggested Stanton, but I would not. They're a difficult lot as it is, I said. If we break into one of their religious ceremonies, they'll probably never forgive us. Let's keep out of any family party where we haven't been invited. That's so, agreed Stanton. The strange tinkling music, if music it can be called, rose and fell, now laden with sorrow, now filled with joy. There's something very unsettling about it, said Edith at last, soberly. I wonder what they make those sounds with. They frighten me half to death, and at the same time they make me feel as though some enormous rapture was just around the corner. I had noticed this effect too, although I had said nothing of it, and at the same time there came to me a clear perception that the chanting which had preceded it had seemed to come from a vast multitude, thousands more than the place we were contemplating could possibly have held. Of course, I thought this might be due to some acoustic property of the basalt, an amplification of sound by some gigantic sounding board of rock. Still, it's devilish uncanny, broke in Stanton, answering my thought. And as he spoke, the flap of Thora's tent was raised, and out into the moonlight strode the old Swede. She was the great Norse type, tall, deep-breasted, molded on the old Viking lines. Her 60 years had slipped from her. She looked like some ancient priestess of Odin. He hesitated. She knew, he said slowly. Something more far-seeing than my science had given her sight. She warned me. Fools and mad that we are to pass such things by without heed. He brushed a hand over his eyes. She stood there, he went on. Her eyes were wide, brilliant, staring. She thrust her head forward toward Nantanak, regarding the moving lights. She listened. Suddenly she raised her arms and made a curious gesture to the moon. It was an archaic movement. She seemed to drag it from remote antiquity, yet in it was a strange suggestion of power. Twice she repeated this gesture and the tinkling died away. She turned to us. Go, she said, and her voice seemed to come from far distances. Go from here, and quickly. Go while you may. They have called. She pointed to the islet. They know you are here. They wait. Her eyes widened further. It is there, she wailed. It beckons. The. She fell at Edith's feet, and as she fell, over the lagoon came the tinklings, now with a quicker note of jubilance, almost of triumph. We ran to Thora, Stanton and I, and picked her up. Her head rolled, and her face, eyes closed, turned as though drawn, full into the moonlight. I felt in my heart a throb of unfamiliar fear, for her face had changed again. Stamped upon it was a look of mingled transport and horror. Alien, terrifying, strangely revolting, it was... He thrust his face close to my eyes. What do you see in mine? For a dozen heartbeats I stared at him, fascinated. Then he sank back again into the half-shadow of the berth. I managed to hide her face from Edith, he went on. I thought she had suffered some kind of a nervous seizure. We carried her into her tent. Once within, the unholy mask dropped from her, and she was again only the kindly, rugged old woman. I watched her throughout the night. The sounds from Nantanak continued until about an hour before moonset. In the morning, Thora awoke, none the worse, apparently. She had had bad dreams, she said. She could not remember what they were, except that they had warned her of danger. She was oddly sullen, and I noticed that throughout the morning her gaze returned again half fascinatedly, half wonderingly to the neighboring isles. That afternoon, the natives returned. They were so exuberant in their apparent relief to find us well and intact that Stanton's suspicions of them were confirmed. He slyly told their leader that, from the noise they had made on Nantanak the night before, they must have thoroughly enjoyed themselves. I think I never saw such stark terror as the Ponapean manifested at this remark. Stanton himself was so plainly startled that he tried to pass it over as a jest. He met poor success. The men seemed panic-stricken, and for a time I thought they were about to abandon us. But they did not. They pitched their camp at the western side of the island, out of sight of Nantanak. I noticed that they...
Eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one, zero.
Go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Hello, hello. It is, let's see. Yes, it is the 20th of May, 2023, and I am starting late. Which means that this show may not archive. Now, I have very good reasons for starting late. And those reasons have to do with the Zeppelin the Musical. Yes, I went today to see the matinee performance, 2 p.m. local time, so 1200 UTC, of Zeppelin the Musical. I had to leave the house at 10 a.m. local time, 4 hours before curtain. Essentially because in this bit of Germany, there, on Saturdays, the train schedule is not so great. Well, the train schedule down to Füssen is not so great altogether, which is a questionable thing when you realize that Füssen lives by tourism. Füssen is the town closest to Hohenschwangau, and thus to Schloss Neuschwanstein, King Ludwig II's fairy tale castle. And the money that comes into Füssen is almost exclusively from people who come to visit Neuschwanstein and hikers and backpackers who come to do things in the Alps. And of course, those people travel most on weekends. So Füssen is a place which ought to have more train service on weekends than the rest of the time. I don't believe that German authorities have considered this kind of place as possible to exist. I will say, That on Saturdays, there is a special service called the Neuschwanstein Express late on, which goes directly between Munich Central Station and Fussen without having to change in Buchloe. For reasons I have described before, that the line is not electrified beyond Buchloe. Normally this is not possible, but because there are fewer other trains running into Munich Central Station on a Saturday, they can run these diesel trains in and out a couple of times during the day. Anyway, the whole thing is a serious mess, because when I got down to Fussen, I discovered that there was, in fact, no transit to the Festspielhaus. I wound up hiring a cab to get there, thinking that, well, when I get there, I can investigate what possibilities there are of transit to get back, and the answer was there was none. So I wound up, after the performance, walking back. And the thing is, it's only 2-2.5 kilometers from the city center, or from the Hauptbahn, from the railway station, anyway. And that's sort of a key concept here, I think, because it wouldn't be too difficult to run some kind of transit. In fact, in my opinion, they could very usefully, because I exaggerate about the economy of Fussen, there is some kind of an industrial district, I suspect it processes dairy and forestry products mostly. There seems to be enough traffic in the region that would warrant a small streetcar service, which would certainly run out to the Festspielhaus, an enormous venue built specifically for musical theater, which has great parking for cars, and apparently tour buses come. I saw one that I asked, inquired of the driver, and found out that he was going to Stuttgart, so I didn't try to bribe my way on board. Stuttgart, yes, not where I needed to go. But, you know, I found a placard intimating that there ought to be a bus service which served the venue specifically at performance times on the days when there are performances, namely Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, but the placard was dated 2002, and there was no indication that any such service was really in effect. Matter of fact, there was some kind of a sign with a typical bus stop sign, but saying this is where you can pick up a taxi that you can hire for the price of bus fare through the municipal service, with the following limitations, one being that you had to reserve it for a specific time at least an hour beforehand, and since I wasn't really sure how long the show was, even if I could have found a payphone or something, and I know you're saying, well, yeah, this is Roy, you should carry a mobile phone, and it's like, yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe I could have walked up to the nearby Gasthaus and convinced the clerk to call me a cab, which probably would have cost me more than the 12 euros that I paid for the cab service from the station to the Festspielhaus, again, a distance of about 2 kilometers. It was technically like 11, and I gave the guy 12 because, you know, cabbies deserve to live, I guess, as much as anyone else, right? Perhaps more so than some people. So that's a picture of the situation as it is in Germany. Very, very car-focused, with very little provision made, even where there's an obvious reason to do so. I mean, there's obvious reasons to have a tram net in the Fussen area, which will take you, at a very minimum, to the Festspielhaus and to the stations for the funiculars that take you to the ski resorts and the castles and so on in the area. This would be a very good investment of money! Because if you haven't actually seen the city center of Fussen, you won't know what I mean. But it's all hotels and hostels for tourists and backpackers. All of it. Entirely. And of course there is no reason to believe that all those people would come by car. And there's no reason to believe that all of them, you know, are from Germany or anything like that. You know, you really want... Okay. So here's the thing. Basically, my advice is, if you're going to Fussen, take a bicycle on the train. That's my advice. If I'd taken a bicycle on the train, I could have gotten where I was going much faster. That's my advice. There's bike paths everywhere. And bicycling is heavily practiced, even in the rural areas. but still there's a huge amount of car traffic. That's my suggestion for you. And again, you know, Germans who claim to be so climate conscious when they're shutting down their non-fossil fueled electric capacity and all that, still certainly are using, you know, people, they want to ban short-haul air flights, but taking measures to reduce the need for a car in outlying areas, that doesn't seem to figure into the picture at all.
Are you doing your radio show?
Yeah.
Have fun. Here's some pizza.
Thanks. Anyway, so that's my impression of Fussen and the Festspielhaus. Now, I could talk about Zeppelin the musical. It was quite the experience. I'll just say that, quite the experience. I said earlier when I was talking about going that I expected it to be a mess. Certainly, they made extremely good use of the many and varied facilities offered by the stage at the Festspielhaus. The Festspielhaus has a rotating stage, and there were certain scenes where the rotating stage was actually in motion while the performers were performing, that they used the rotation of the stage as part of the staging, which I thought was great. Next, there was a scene where they were actually had a second smaller area of the stage that rotated independently of the full stage, and that was used, but not to any great effect. They had a cabaret stage for Berlin in 1937, and it was sort of rotating back and forth slightly, but only a little. I don't think it added to the staging very much. And then in another scene, they actually had flooded a sizable portion of the stage with water to represent the waters of Lake Constance, where the early Zeppelin flights were conducted. So that's, from a technical perspective, quite interesting. Bob Junkman asks what the bike rental situation is and if there's bike share. And my answer, as far as I know, only in the major cities. There are bike rental agencies, I think, in the rural places, which are open regular business hours. And so, you know, basically 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. And so you can pick up a bike and rent it for a weekend, assuming you get there before 5 on Friday. So that's as far as I know about bike rental in rural Bavaria. Anyway, but the other thing was, of course, that they did have a 5-meter-long airship that flew out over the audience. Of course, I was in the balcony, in the cheap seats, and so it sort of flew under me, but, well, it didn't fly far enough over the audience to actually get under the balcony. But they did have a 5-meter-long airship, which, if you were paying close attention, you would have noticed did not have tail fins for stabilization because it was entirely controlled by thrust vectoring. And I'm presuming that it was under radio control. It sort of drifted around the auditorium for a while during one of the numbers. So those are my sort of technical observations about the staging of Zeppelin the Musical. Now, I admit that this was perhaps not the best time for me to go see a play which ends, unsurprisingly, with the destruction by fire of the Hindenburg during its attempt to land at Lakehurst, New Jersey, on the first North American flight of 1937. And if that's a spoiler to you, I'm sorry. But, you know, I don't feel the need to give spoiler warnings for well-known pieces of world history. I just plain don't. But suffice to say that I'm getting on an airplane Monday morning very early to fly to America, so this may not have been the exact best time for me to go see this particular play. But But of course, as I often, you know, as everyone knows, air travel does remain very safe. I would honestly prefer to go by Zeppelin rather than by Reynolds Wrap Rocket. You know, I just don't like the sensation of being shoved into a tube for 14 hours. I would much have preferred to, you know, to travel by sea, but the sea routes at present. Well, suffice to say, I have a strict deadline to be back home in Texas, and the Queen Mary would have gotten me back to the U.S. too late to meet that deadline. Because I looked into when I asked the question, when are the sailings of the Queen Mary? Because in principle, if one is going over in the spring, one could take what's known as a repositioning cruise from this, because the cruise liners operate in the Caribbean waters, particularly in over the winter season, and then they move to the Mediterranean to operate during the summer, and then they move back in the autumn. And so, in principle, one could take a cruise liner repositioning, a non-round trip, from, say, a port in even possibly the port of Galveston, which serves cruise liners, to a port in somewhere in Europe that's served by a railway network from which connections can be made to Munich. And then later in the year, one could take the Queen Mary, but as it was, the schedule just would not work. Again, I am the victim of poor scheduling at all times. Let's see, I did want to get you up to date on what's been going on with the Theater of the Atom, specifically with the two German payphones that I bought. So I have succeeded in getting them into operation, including charging, using a special ATA, analog telephony adapter. These are the endpoints that allow you to use a standard telephone with voice over internet protocol service. Well, of course, these payphones are not quite standard telephones, so I had to get a special ATA, which would handle the particular requirements that they have. Regular German telephone doesn't mind much, but the unfortunately, the payphones do. They require a higher open circuit voltage and a larger loop current. But I got them working, including the charging feature, which is supported by this ATA, under a local asterisk running a little netbook that I have that I installed Slackware on. It's not without its problems, but it is working. And now I haven't yet figured out a really good way to get it to play a video file and play back the audio through the telephone. It ought to be possible to do it with a music on hold feature, but I can't get the music on hold feature to work. For whatever reason, the asterisk just does not recognize the existence of the relevant configuration file. I thought maybe it would be a permissions problem, because that often occurs with Unix-type systems, but I made sure to duplicate the permissions from the example file. I don't know. But what I can do is set it up to play the roughly 10-minute-long selections from the sets of Atomic Energy Commission records that I have. So that will be my interim, to convert those, clean up those audio files and convert them to ALAW PCM files, and then store them on the little netbook, and then again, just set it up so people can put in their Deutschmarks, which I will happily sell them at some inflated price, and then they can listen to the audio. Actually, it's not much of an inflated price. I'm thinking if I can rent a capsule vending machine in Winnipeg, I'll put two Deutschmarks, or apparently British shillings work as well, from by my testing, two Deutschmarks into a capsule along with a sticker, and every 10th capsule will have a button in it. Anyway, and the price of them should, the price of the, each audio program should be about 2 tokens. So that should work fine. Anyway, you've been listening to something resembling A Step Farther Out, which is every Saturday on Anon Radio, a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System, at 1900 UTC, if I am able to do it. If you'd like to support these broadcasts, support my Patreon, patreon.com/man Yeah, fuck it. I'm sorry, Tobe with the Dubious Goals Committee is next.